from the ethical guide to life, the sacred scriptures of Buddhism, and a path to the ending of suffering. And I'm going to give you a little bit of background, and many of you, I think, were many people here at the early Buddhism course we did a few years ago? Many of you are here? Most of you are here? I'll just give you, does anyone want to summarize the history of the transmission of suttas from then till now? So you were students, but you were bad students. That was a couple of years ago. No, I'm only kidding. But just a bit of a refresher, so I'll just run over this quickly, but I assume most of you are at least somewhat familiar with this. So the Buddha's oral teachings were memorized and organized by his disciples. The early texts that we have today in Pali are the four Nikayas, the six early books of the Kuddhika Nikaya and the Vinaya. And all other texts for later, very similar collections were maintained by the schools. They were written down, we think, about 400 years after the Buddha. And both early and late texts were taken to China and Tibet and translated there. And so this is why we have the different collections of what we call the early Buddhist texts. So in the those of us who sort of work in this field, sometimes abbreviated as EBTs. And so this is what the EBTs are, the early Buddhist texts, is the four Nikayas, the six early books of the Kuddhika, the Vinaya, and the similar or corresponding texts in Pali Chinese and, in Sanskrit Chinese and Tibetan. Yeah. That's one of the six early books. Yeah, so the six early books of the Kuddhika are the Udana, the Itivuttaka, the Terattarigata, Dhammapada, and Suttanipata. Yeah. Okay. And so here's just a few images of manuscripts, so you can get an idea what these things are, the physical remnants which have come down to us. These are some manuscript fragments in Gandhari, and these ones recovered from Afghanistan and are being studied by an academic group led by Richard Solomon in the States, and including Mark Allen, who works, a friend of mine, works at Sydney Uni. And the editing and publishing and study of these Gandhari manuscripts is one of the major projects of modern Buddhist studies, which has, these are now the oldest Indian manuscripts of any kind, and are certainly the oldest Buddhist manuscripts. They're nearly 2,000 years old. So these date from not that long after the suttas were written down. So Gandhari is an ancient Indian language which is fairly similar to Pali. So it's a kind of a cousin of Pali. Although if you know Pali, you'll struggle a bit with Gandhari. I don't know Gandhari personally, but you can make up most things. Here's a Tibetan manuscript, just as an example of the, again, the physical transmission. And here's one in Pali. And so you can see this is a palm leaf manuscript. So they would prepare these strips from the palm leaves, and then the scribe would write with like a steel, almost like a needle. So they would scrape on it, and then when they've scraped on it, then you would dust it with the ink, and then wipe it off. That would make the thing. So this is why the Sri Lankan, you might have noticed, Sri Lankan and Burmese writing is all very curly. And so this is why, because the palm leaf manuscript is easily cut. So if you're doing horizontal lines on it, you'll easily cut the material. So they have to make them curly so you don't have any straight lines that's going to cut it. So it's just interesting to see how those details of the textual transmission can affect incidental details can affect how things are received and how they're transmitted. So to the modern history, in the 19th century, texts in Pali, Chinese, Tibetan and Sanskrit were collated and published in book form. Parallels were identified by mostly Japanese scholars in the early 20th century. The earliest ones to identify parallels between Pali and Chinese scriptures were, in fact, Samuel Beale around the middle of the 19th century, who noted a few parallels between the Padimokkhas and so on, and the Japanese scholar Nanjio. and later on Chisinakanuma and Eseki were some of the scholars who went more systematically through and compiled lists of several thousand parallels between Pali and Chinese texts. Those lists of parallels were then corrected and expanded during the 20th century by a series of scholars and digitized, and then they are now the basis for Sutta Central. The Pali Text Society translated almost the whole Pali canon. And in the 19, so that's also very important because the text up until then had mostly been taught or transmitted in the original language. So you didn't have sort of a lot of translations of texts in the different Buddhist countries, but they would just be the original language texts. And of course, usually only specialists, most of whom would probably be monks, would learn Pali or something, and then it was their responsibility to explain them. But if you didn't know Pali, then you couldn't read them, for the most part. And so in the 20th century, the Pali Text Society really kind of sparked a program of translating texts. And of course, they were translated into many other languages apart from English. In the 1990s and 2000s, the texts were digitized, and there were various projects to digitize the texts in Pali, Chinese, and so on. And here's just a couple of images to give a record of that time. This is a page from the Pali Text Society edition of the Digha Nikaya. And notice how that they've adopted some of the conventions of Western bookmaking. Right? So, for example, you have a title. Right? So in the ancient Indic manuscripts, they don't have titles. So here they have a title. And notice also they have footnotes. And those footnotes record variant readings. So they've collated different manuscripts, and between the different manuscripts they'll have a few what they call variant readings. So usually just minor variations in spelling from one manuscript to the next, and they'll be noted in those footnotes. So these are some of the text critical apparatus of modern books which have been applied from the early 20th century to the Buddhist texts. Here's another image. This is a Chinese manuscript from Dunhuang being digitized. So in the early 20th century, various expeditions into the desert regions in the west of China came across, led by German archaeologists or adventurers. I think in those days it wasn't too much difference between the two. So this was a kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of a deal. And they went into the desert and they discovered these huge troves of manuscripts. And those manuscripts are still being collated and digitized and so on. And as you can see, it's a very difficult, very painstaking process. And some of those Dunhuang manuscripts are on Sutta Central now. Yeah. These ones from Dunhuang, I think, are about 1,500 years old, about 1,700 years old. So they're a bit younger than the Gandhari ones, and but still quite old, yeah. Yeah. Both the images, initially they'd be scanned, so this is a manuscript being prepared for scanning. Or photographing, and then they would, over time, they would be entered in as well. But that's a long, slow process because you need real specialists to do it. So, whereas scanning, it's quite relatively simple. So, yeah, it takes time. And there's so few people working in the field because it's very boring. Right? It's a very painstaking job. Yeah.
So, I mean, just for my chronological orientation, I mean, do you know roughly which dynasty does that correspond to?
Sorry, my Chinese history is very bad.
Okay.
I can't remember.
So if it's 1500, did you say 1500?
Don't quote me on that. Old. Yeah, you can have a look at the history. It's quite well documented online. Yeah, you can find. There's a sort of fairly comprehensive digital archive of that being maintained by the British Museum, among others. So you can find the details there. Yeah. There's another important edition. And this is a Tripitaka Koreana and maintained in Korea. This is, despite its location, is the Chinese Buddhist canon. And this was an edition which was created by a Korean king in the 13th century. And as you can see from that image, that's a wooden block, They're in incredibly good condition, and this is the most pristine historical edition of Buddhist texts. And you can see the building behind them and the rows of slabs of inscribed slabs, wooden slabs there. So they are all full of the Chinese Buddhist canon. And the modern digital editions of Buddhist texts are mostly derived from that particular edition. So they'll make paper rubbings of them. Right? So they get each one and rub it with pencil. And then they'll type it in, digitize it. And so these are the ones we use, and they're incredible. The craftsmanship and the care that went into these was really astonishing. Okay, so sort of central, obviously the most important part of what we're talking about, started in 2004 by Rod Bucknell, Bhante Siddhartha, that's me, and John Kelly. So Rod and John are two friends of mine and Buddhist scholars from Brisbane. Rod is a retired professor of Buddhist studies. John is, in case you're wondering, Paul's brother. Really? So, in 2005 we brought the first site online, and it was a very simple site with the Sutta parallels supplied by Rod, and external links to texts, but we had a bit of a problem because we linked to lots of external sites and many of them went dead or changed their links or whatever. So in 2012 we rebuilt it, we added the texts hosted natively, both the original texts and translations. We added search, Vinaya parallels, which I compiled, lookup tools and various other things. So that rebuild in 2012 was a huge shift in what we were doing. And that's really served us well up till now, when we have now rebuilt it again. And the new rebuild, which we've just launched for Sutta Central, has new translations by myself of the four Nikayas. We also include a new translation by Brahmali of the Vinaya. And Ajahn Brahmali's Vinaya translation has been ongoing for a few years now. And it started out actually when we were putting the old I.B. Horner translation, and we digitized that, and we were putting that on Sutta Central, and we were like, oh, there's these few things that we've been wanting to fix in this translation, a few mistakes, and now we have the chance to make a corrected version. So we started making a few corrections to that, and then he's like, oh, well, I might as well just do it all myself. So that's what he's doing. So now he's retranslating the whole Vinaya, and about most of that's actually done, and we're hoping that the whole of the Vinaya will be completed and online by the end of the year. These texts are segmented, these new translations, which means that you can see the Pali and the English side by side. And we have the user interface is internationalized. We support offline usage via progressive web apps. We have thousands more parallels that's been added for things like Dhammapada verses. And we have built translation software so that people can translate the suttas into third languages, so into languages other than Pali and English. So we want to support the creation of a new generation of translations in the world's languages. So even though currently we have translations in around 40 languages, including in the Metta Sutta in Arabic, which we have, which is very nice. A friend of ours in Sri Lanka did that, an Egyptian monk. And we also have the Metta Sutta now in Sindarin. Right? So anyone know what Sindarin is? Well, yeah, well, apart from those teeth, Sindarin is the language of the elves from the Lord of the Rings. So now any... well, it's all sentient beings, right? Yeah, those who exist and those who do not exist. So any elves can now read the Metta Sutta in Sindarin. We're looking for a Klingon translator. If anybody wants to do Klingon for us, that would be good. But even though we have now many translations, they're still far from perfect. Many of the translations are not particularly accurate. They might be incomplete, or all of them are incomplete. We don't have complete sets of translations of all the early Buddhist texts in any language. The most complete is Vietnamese, and the second most complete would probably be English. Indonesian is rapidly catching up. Congratulations to the Indonesians. They've been doing a great job. Or the translations may be inconsistent. They're done by different people in different ways at different times. And sometimes also they're very hard to understand. And a lot of people tell us that our friends in Thailand will tell us that they prefer to read as such as in English than in Thai, because they're so much easier to understand. And in addition, many translations are encumbered by copyright. And this is a bit of a bugbear for me, because I think that the Buddha's teachings should be freely available. And I don't think that we should be using... copyright is a legal mechanism developed in the West in the 20th century, whose purpose is to protect the income of creative artists. And I don't think it's appropriate to apply it to Buddhist texts, which have never been intended to create an income for anybody. So this is what we have, 70 million words on Sutta Central in about 40 languages, about 70,000 texts, 30,000 or so parallels, and one Dhamma. And so a couple of years ago, when I decided to embark on this project, I had a number of aims in my translation that I wanted to try to achieve. First of all, to make it complete and consistent across the four main Nikayas, and so far this has never been done, as far as I know, in any language, that to have it completely consistent across the four main Nikayas. I wanted to have it in plain and modern English, not complicated English. And those of you who know me will know that this was one of the hardest parts of the whole job. And my natural idiom is complicated English. And I had to constantly be trying to, make it simpler, make it more straightforward. And so it's not a matter of dumbing ideas down, but it's just a matter of expressing them in the most simple and direct manner possible. And the translations are completely free of copyright, so you can take them and do anything with them if you like. There's no legal consequences. There may be karmic consequences, but there's no legal consequences. Okay. So we're, as far as I'm concerned, it's as Buddhists, it's our spiritual duty to take Buddhist suttas and to share them with others and with people to help them relieve their suffering. And I don't think we should be turning our vocation as Buddhists into a criminal activity. The texts are, as I mentioned before, segmented or matched phrase by phrase with the original Pali, and they're also accompanied by over 100 essays on various translation issues. And here I'm just going to go quickly past a couple of issues in the details in the translation that I thought were somewhat interesting, and then we might have a look more at some of the translations. So this is just to give you some idea of some of the principles that I used when making the translations and my kind of considerations and methodologies in making the changes that I've made from earlier renderings. So we have this nice phrase in some of the suttas where it talks about when the Buddha was enlightened and this great light filled, this radiant light filled the whole universe. And the beings who were born in those interstellar wastes were able to perceive each other by that light. So I really like that kind of thing, all these kind of aliens floating around in space and all suddenly being revealed to each other. Now, in the older translations, it called this the abysmal reaches of interstellar space or something like that. And so the word abysmal is kind of a curious choice of word in there. So what really does abysmal mean? I mean, it's from the word abyss, meaning a deep chasm, but it also has the sense of terrible or horrible. But the underlying Pali word, and I was quite surprised to see this, was asanguta, which doesn't mean abysmal at all. It means boundless. And so how did we get from boundless to abysmal? Right? It's a kind of a bit of a leap, isn't it? So what's happened is that in the commentaries, they describe the different world systems as being like plates. Okay? So if you imagine you have... different plates, and so your world systems are sort of arranged like on a table. So you can imagine like a table, and they kind of butt up against each other. And so when they butt up against each other, then there are these spaces in between, Right? And those spaces in between are these empty spaces that the sutra is talking about. And so they sort of plunge downwards in a two-dimensional cosmos. Well, it's really the cosmos itself is kind of two-dimensional, but then this bit obviously is a third-dimensional. But the idea is that the universe is kind of arranged on a two-dimensional plane. And so this is why they use the word, according to the commentary description of abysmal, in the sense of plunging down into an abyss. Right? So that's kind of weird, isn't it? Because actually the universe isn't really like that. And the universe isn't two-dimensional. It's very much three-dimensional, if not more. And the suttas don't have anything about a two-dimensional universe. So I thought that was an unfortunate sort of concept to bring into the suttas, which don't really have that idea. And instead, the word in the suttas simply means boundless, which works quite well, the boundless desolation of interstellar space. So this just shows you that sometimes the translations can sort of inherit ideas from commentaries and things, which are not always really found in the texts themselves. So this is another one, just a little bit of a detail, but in Pali we have the word pasada, which is usually translated as palace or mansion. But when it's described, normally when you're talking about houses and buildings in Pali, it talks about entering and leaving them, right? So there is words for it to enter a house and to leave a house. But for a pasada, it's always said you ascend a pasada or you descend from an pasada. And it even talks about having to build a staircase to get into them. So clearly a pasada must be some kind of elevated building, probably what they call a stilt longhouse, right? Something like this. And so this is a kind of building which is very, very common throughout the Asian cultural sphere. And as you can see, they can be pretty big and very nice buildings, so it doesn't mean that it's just a little hut or something like that. They can be quite magnificent buildings, but it's an elevated building on some stilts. So that doesn't, in a sense, that doesn't really matter. You know, it's only a small detail, and who cares what kind of building it was really? At the same time, though, when we pay close attention to all of those details, we paint a more vivid picture of what life was really like in those days. And so we're able to get a little bit closer to the culture and to the life that was being lived by the people at the time. And so, you know, when we're doing that translation, it's important for us to pay, you know, equal attention to those kinds of incidental details as we do to doctrinal details and so on. Yeah. Sure, for sure, yeah. It would frequently take a morning or even a couple of days to research a particular word, yeah. 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 This one, there's a long conversation between myself and Ajahn Brahmali on this and also various other points of discussing different architectural details and so on. Yeah, so we were back and forth. He was the one who first pointed this detail out, yeah. But yes, very much so. And so, you know, Pali is a well-known and well-studied language, right? It's not a particularly obscure language. It's actually quite clear. And Indian linguistic science is incredible, okay? And the work of Panini, the ancient Indian grammarist, is the one of the, if not the most advanced work in any field until modern times, really. I mean, it's just incredible, yeah. It's an incredibly powerful, systematic, abstract understanding of grammar, which was already present in the Buddha's day or a little bit later. And so they had this second to none linguistic science, so they were able to understand all the languages, to analyze them and comment on them and so on. And so generally speaking, our understanding of the languages is extremely good. But of course, there are always details that we're not familiar with. And so sometimes we have to look, if it's not obvious from the context, we might look in the Sanskrit texts, we might look in the Chinese translations, we'll look at what the commentators say, and so on. And so you can usually get a pretty good idea of what the text is actually saying. Yeah, and if I ran out of ideas, I'd email to Ajahn Brahmali or to Venerable Ananda Jyoti or some of my other friends and say, help. And then they'd usually write back and say, yeah, it seems unclear. So I say, thanks a lot. So, but no, but no. People, you know, we help each other out with the different specialities. So this is another point which is quite interesting. Some of you may know the story of the shorter discourse on the ending of craving, when Saka, the king of the gods, hears a teaching from the Buddha, returns to his heaven, and Moggallana thinks that Saka wasn't really listening. So he goes up to try to test him and to make sure that he was listening properly. And when Moggallana visited Saka in his palace, the different translations usually say something like embarrassed and ashamed. Each of the celestial maidens fled to her chamber. Something like that. And so you get this, I had this impression from reading these translations that there was this, they were kind of like this bunch of giggly girls who were like, and blushing and running back to their rooms because they felt that, they felt they'd been doing something naughty or something like that. And again, I was somewhat surprised when I looked closely at what the Pali said, because what the Pali says is otapamana, hiriyamana, conscientious and discreet. Okay? Which is quite a different sense, isn't it? Yeah? And otapa and hiri are called by the Buddha the two guardians of the world. Right? That's the inner sense of conscience, which is the essential foundation for all moral conduct. And so according to all Buddhist cosmology, each of those celestial maidens must have been born in that realm because they've done good deeds in the past. They were born into a happy realm. So they've been generous and kind and kept precepts in their past lives. And as a genuine and well-deserved reward for that, they had been reborn in that heaven. And then when they saw that Saka, the king, was receiving an important guest, because they were discreet, they retired to their room so as not to disturb the important guest, right? Especially important because if Saka was going to be a bit embarrassed because Moggallana was going to give him a telling off, so they didn't want to humiliate him too much by doing it in front of everyone. But anyway, so they went to their room. So there's no implication here that they've done anything wrong. But if we say that they're embarrassed and ashamed, then it certainly feels as if that they've got something to be ashamed of. So it's interesting that those slight shifts in your translation can make quite a difference in the feel of the passage. This is another one which is a bit similar. So at that time there was like a superstar, a performer called the Janapada Kalyani, usually translated as the most beautiful girl in the land. Right, but she's described as being a performer. She's like, will be doing singing and dancing and these kinds of things. In Pali, there are many different words to mean beauty. But kalyana doesn't normally mean beauty at all. Kalyana means, the most common usage of kalyana is to mean morally good. Okay, so kalyana is the normal opposite of papa. Papangwa kalyanangwa, right, is good and bad. Or else it means fine or excellent or something like that. And so that's kind of curious, isn't it? Yeah? That word, which actually doesn't mean physical beauty at all, is translated purely to mean that she's beautiful. So that's the only quality which is actually brought forth in the translation. And again, it's only a small shift, but to me that gives a different kind of a different kind of attitude or a different kind of perspective on who this person was. You know, she was a skilled professional performer, not just someone who was known for being beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to say that into the mic?
When the first translation is done through a social and cultural lens,
right,
and so it affects what they think that means.
I do think that, yeah, very much so, and then it's very easy to just sort of keep repeating it, right? So we always have to go back to it and checking it all the time.
Well, I guess then the assumption becomes that that is what it means, as
exactly,
opposed to how it was interpreted.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. Annie?
Go on.
just a comment that I don't think it's a little thing. I think it's a huge thing. The difference in translation. I also a question about the previous example that you gave, where embarrassed and ashamed, each fled to her chamber. How did you translate fled? Because that's the sort of, if you're conscientious and discreet, you don't usually flee. You just sort of, you know.
Yeah, I think I can't recall. I think I just said entered the. I think it's just entered the chamber or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how much of this you had to do, because I'm thinking it was ongoing.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so every day you just begin, and then encounter issues like this you have to deal with each time, yeah. And so, yeah, it's very unpredictable. You know, sometimes the things that you think will be very difficult that turn out to be quite easy, and the things that you think are going to be really easy, then you notice a little detail there, and then you, 2 or 3 days have gone, and then you're like, well, what's happened to that? Schrodinger's cat, yes. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the principles that I used when translating was to make it as simple as possible, but no simpler. And here's just a couple of examples of choices and changes I've made in technical terms. And I've started with one that is relatively straightforward, punyabhisankara, or I've actually done it. It actually should be apunyabhisankara. Demeritorious volitional formations, a classic of Buddhist hybrid English, to bad choices. So I felt pretty comfortable with that. Okay, so I think that's much more legible. Samadhi, so this is on a graduated scale, okay? So that first one I feel pretty comfortable with. Then samadhi, I changed from the usual rendering of concentration to immersion. And this was one of the most difficult terms to translate. I went back and forth many, many, many different times and many, many, many different options. Definitely don't like concentration. Immersion, the reason I chose immersion was because I'm always looking for something that is actually used in our culture in that way. And in the modern English, I think the closest idea that we have to samadhi is the idea of they talk about an immersive experience, right? So if you're like putting on a VR headset or something like that, they'll say it's an immersive experience. It means you're completely inside that world, and you're not aware of anything outside that. And so the word immersion for samadhi, I think, is quite similar to that kind of idea. And that quality of immersion is reflected in many of the similes, the metaphors that's used to talk about samadhi, like the lotus which is growing underneath the cool water of the lake and so on, and soaking through with cool, clear water and things like that. So it's also similar to the word absorption. So I'm using absorption for jhana, and jhana and samadhi have a similar meaning. So I thought also that was quite good. So at the end of the day, I'm not entirely sure, but I was reasonably happy with immersion for samadhi. And then finally is one, a choice that I was less confident about, and I made actually towards the end of the project, but for the translation of Dhamma, specifically when Dhamma is used as the sixth sense base, right? So we normally use the eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, body and touches, and then we have mind and Dhammas. Okay? So mind and Dhammas in that sense. Actually, mental phenomena is quite a good translation, right? Because Dhamma means anything that you can be aware of. So it's actually quite a good translation, but the problem is, it's damn clumsy. And you constantly, oh, mental phenomena this and mental phenomena that, and it's really awkward. So thoughts is actually a bit less accurate, but more kind of readable and more immediately grokkable, right? You can read it and you kind of know what it means, or the mind and thoughts, and you get an idea what it means. Mental phenomena, technically, yeah, it's quite good, but you have to sort of work out what exactly it means by that. So That was one I was not sure about, but at the end of the day, so far I've gone with thoughts for that particular translation. Yeah.
So, I mean, Bhante, you mentioned about this being a real conversation in the distant past. I mean,
right.
Consciousness and Dhamma, you know,
right.
Talking to an average person.
Exactly.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe a bit more educated, okay, or something.
Yeah.
But so, what does that mean to an average, perhaps educated person in
mental phenomena?
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, is that directly apparent?
I don't know.
Yeah. So do they really mean that, or do they really mean just, you know, what's happening in the mind? You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a good question.
Especially during a conversation.
Yeah. It's true, yeah. And sometimes it's hard to know because, you know, sometimes they... there's kind of assumed knowledge in the culture, and so we're not quite sure. But yes, I agree. It's problematic to assume that a concept as abstract as mental phenomena would be widely understood by just your average person on the street. Yeah, Peter.
Mendicant, just seeking clarification. Dharma here in this instance. Are we talking about the fourth Satipatthana? Dharma?
No, different. Translate differently there.
Okay.
Yeah. So only in this particular one, the six senses. Yeah.
You didn't choose stillness.
Could you repeat that?
Usually Ajahn Brahm translates samadhi as stillness. Hmm. I'm just wondering why you... chose immersion rather than stillness?
Yeah, I tried stillness and I tried using it for a while, and it didn't work. Like, it's different when you're using a word in an audience where you know people and you know how you're using it and you can control the context of how you're using it. So you know, you can make sure that people understand what you're using it. But when you're using, say, stillness, you know, you might have something like, the monk in the forest who's mindful and still, right, practicing samadhi, right? The word might be he's in the forest, he's mindful and he's practicing samadhi. So how do you translate that? He's still. So the monk is not moving, yeah? And so it's hard to get the... I found it hard to convey that sense sort of reliably and easily through the translation. Yeah. So this is why I said I've been back and forth with lots of different renderings before finally settling on this one. Yeah.
To me, immersion is really good, but it sort of means also like a movement, doesn't it? Like a movement into immersion. Uh-huh. No?
Well, it can mean either a state of immersion or a process. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But look, fair enough. And you know, I don't. That's why I mentioned that there are these uncertain renderings, and I certainly may have changed them back and forth many times already, and I may change them again. Yeah. Easily. Is there one second? Wait for the mic.
Should samadhi have an aspect of peacefulness, quiet?
Sure.
Rather than leave it open to a translation of anger or excitement.
Why would that... I'm not sure how that...
If you use samadhi as concentration and immersion, but there could be two faces to that. Concentrated anger.
No. The old translation was concentration. So I'm not using that. So I'm using immersion instead.
Could that mean drowning?
Well,
any word can mean something if it's in a different context, for sure.
I'm trying to exclude aggression.
I'm not sure how emotion can convey aggression.
you've got to get the idea of peacefulness in samadhi.
Yeah.
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 Immersed. A peaceful state.
Yeah. Also remember that one of the principles that I use in translating was something which I call the principle of least meaning. And this was probably one of the most helpful things that I relied on, the principle of least meaning, right? And what the principle of least meaning is that when we're reading ancient texts, we always tend to overburden them. We always tend to sort of pile on top of them all of the things we want them to mean, right? Pile our interpretations. And so the poor old words are struggling along with these just little words, just a little word, samadhi, and it's got this big burden of history on its back and all of the commentators and all of the interpreters. And in Thailand, samadhi means one thing. It means meditation. In India, samadhi means the union of the little Atman with the big Atman in the sky, right? And in different places, samadhi means so many different things. And so the poor little word has to sort of somehow struggle to actually work in a sentence with all of those different projections on it. So I always try to come back to what I call the principle of least meaning, was to basically to not overburden words with meaning. Because words really only have meaning in a context, in the context of a sentence or a passage or a paragraph. And a paragraph is more able to bear meaning well, yeah, or a sentence. It's got broader back, and you can convey a more clear meaning through that. So rather than trying to overload a particular word with meaning, we try to look at how it works in the context. So when I'm translating, so what I'll do is I'll look at how these words work in their context and how the sentence or the paragraph conveys that meaning as best as possible. So that's always the most important criterion for me. Yeah. But, you know, this is one of the characteristics of the translation. It's a digital translation. It will be revised. And, you know, I'll keep on revising it as I go. And if it turns out that another rendering works better, great.
Bante, do you use the different words in different situations? Because sometimes samadhi is used in slightly different ways.
Sure.
You could sort of use immersion in one case, one pointedness in another, and say focused in another, or stillness in another, and so on and so forth.
To some extent, yes. Although in Buddhism, the technical terms like samadhi tend to be used fairly consistently, and it's generally speaking a good idea to try to use to translate them as consistently as possible. So of course that doesn't mean that they can or should be 100% consistent. Certainly a word like dhamma needs to be translated quite differently in different contexts. So we just try to do our best. But generally speaking, what I would try to do is to say settle on one rendering. And keep that one rendering unless there was a good reason to use another rendering. Yeah. So, yeah. So like it says, it would be as consistent as possible, but no consistenter. Okay. So just a bit of a kind of summing up. So the Dhamma is very beautiful, so we let it shine. We don't need to change or adapt the Dhamma, we just need to get out of the way. When I'm a translator, my job is to just step back. I have to try not to insert myself into it, not to insert my ideas as much as possible, but to just try to let the Dhamma speak. And the fact that we have these teachings is quite incredible. And it's not an accident. It's because of the hard work of many generations of Buddhists who have copied the manuscripts and memorized the texts and taught them and built buildings to house the manuscripts in and all of those kinds of things. And then there needs to be that kind of physical effort and work, generosity of spending of both funds and time and land and space in order to maintain the Dhamma. So I believe that part of my duty as a Buddhist and as a Buddhist monk, I believe that the Sangha are the traditional custodians of these texts. It's our duty to look after them, to share them with people, to practice them, and also to pass them down to future generations so that true Dhamma may last long. Sorry? refine?
You have to add an aspect of refinement as well.
Do I?
Don't you?
Well, in terms of the work of translators and so on, then yes, yeah, we try to refine what they've done, and to try because things always deteriorate,
yes.
Right? So yeah, we always try to sort of polish it up a bit and present it in the best way we can. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just a question. I mean, looking at how well preserved those texts were, I mean, historically, and people generally during the olden days were less educated than now, I mean, generally speaking, I mean, population-wise. I mean, so it was incredible that those texts were so well preserved. So is it valid to think that earlier generations of Buddhists were more committed to the suttas than later generations? I don't know. That they were so incredibly preserved and memorized.
Sure, yeah.
So on.
Well, it was. I'm not really sure about that, but you can certainly say that it was a lot more work in those days, you know? In one of my favourite stories of one of the Chinese pilgrims, I think it was Faxian, who walked from China to India across the desert to retrieve the suttas. And you think about how far that is and how some of the harshest country in the world. And he walked all that way, and he said that sometimes his only guidepost in the sands of the desert was the bleached bones of the former travellers who had died before him. So that was how he found his way. And so these days we complain if the menu requires an extra click, then it's too hard to to get what we want quickly enough. Yeah. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is just maybe just discuss briefly just a couple of texts or translations and things like that, but just open up. Anyone, any more questions? So as well as doing the translation, we built the new website, sort of central, and it's very nice, and you can click things and read stuff. So that's good. We've even got some pretty pictures, so you can look at those. And we've got a soundtrack. We got some music made for us and a video and things. Do you want to see the video? I don't know if the... Yeah, just Google sort of central. I don't know if this is going to 100% work, because I'm not sure how good the connection is here. All right. It's a bit of an experiment. And I've also got sound as well, so...
We've all heard of the Buddha, and we know his reputation. He was a man of peace and wisdom. What do we really know about the Buddha and his teachings?
Sorry about this, just getting the
maybe we've heard some of his ideas and images
filtered
through the lens of history and tradition. The monkey mind that's calmed in meditation. The raft that's for crossing over and not for holding on. Or the handful of leaves in the forest. Where do these teachings come from? How do we know what the Buddha taught? On Sutta Central, you'll find all these teachings and many more. We gather the earliest texts of the Buddhist traditions, show the connections between them, and offer translations in the world's languages. Now Sutta Central is proud to publish Bhante Sujato's new translation of the four Pali Nikayas, our primary source for the Buddha's words. For the very first time, these core scriptures are freely available in an accurate, modern translation in plain English. In times of darkness and confusion, we could all do with a little wisdom. Thank you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's done some by some of our Sri Lankan friends in Sydney. Yeah, good, huh? So we have our own theme music and video. Yeah.
Whose idea was it to put music when somebody is talking? Because we find that you can get different accents or a higher pitched in voice, and you're not concentrating on what they're saying. This music is there annoying you, if you know what I mean.
Well, I'm sorry that you were annoyed by the music, but I thought it was very nice. But then, because I'm a monk, I'm not allowed to listen to music these days. So it was my only excuse to be able to listen to music.
Whenever we're watching a documentary, suddenly in comes this music and we say, why do they have to keep playing music when they're talking? So just a thought. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so... Any more questions? If you don't have any questions, I might just have a look at a particular translation of a sutta or something like that, but I'm happy to answer any more questions while going on. Yeah.
I just want to clarify that slide that you showed us for the Dharma. We're under Dharma and you had the thoughts that the translation... It just made me start to think again about the word Dharma because I don't understand Dharma in its complexity, but I think in general that it's like the truth or nature as well. When I think Dharma, I think the truth of it.
Sure, yeah, in some cases, yeah. So
That was just one aspect that you had under Dharma, wasn't it?
So if you go onto Sutta Central, you can search for the word Dharma and you get the dictionary definition, which is a very nice dictionary definition. One of the things that we've done, one of the many, 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 many projects that we've done and work that we've done that isn't part of that description that I've shared with you so far, is that we've revised and improved the dictionaries that are available. And so this is using the latest and most accurate definitions found by done by Margaret Cohn in her ongoing series of dictionaries on Pali. And so we've extracted those. So meanings for Dharma, how the world of experience works, the processes by which it works and is explained, and the possibility and way of transcending it is understood by the Buddha and taught by him. So that's fairly complex, isn't it? Yeah? The stages to freedom from the worlds of experience, complicating in Nibbana, the behavior, conduct, practice required to realize and understand the way the world of experience works, quality or element of behavior or practice, constitute a prescribed practice, element of teaching, the substance of the teaching of the Buddha, and so on, and various other translations which are here. There's another up to 8 meanings. So Dhamma has different meanings in different contexts. Yeah. So, yeah. Yes.
With such a massive collection of the Buddha suttas, how would you recommend one started?
Okay, good question. So one of the things about Sutta Central is that we're kind of, well, at least historically, we've been kind of intimidating, and we basically assume that you pretty much know Pali and Sanskrit already and stuff. So that's where, you know, that's a kind of beginner's level. So, because it was put together by a bunch of scholars and stuff, and, you know, we assume, well, most people know Pali, don't they? I mean, come on. So one of the things that we've tried to do is to be a bit more friendly in this one and to give a little bit of guidance as to do things like where to begin. So you can go here and then this will give you a few bit of guidance and some tips, places you can go, resources that you can use to get started. Yeah, good point. Yes, the Anguttara is actually probably the best place to start for most people because it's nice and short and simple suttas. So often we begin with the... here's us. We got on there. BSWA Sutta classes. Yay, we're famous now. So, we often start with more complicated suttas, whereas actually, many of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya are nice and simple and short, very shareable, and, I could do, I probably should do. Yeah. The five funny ones. you can actually have a look at that. That's quite nice. This lady, what's her name? Minda, who does a series of sutta readings and stuff like that. Mindali Kumar. And she does a nice series on the suttas and various aspects of Buddhism and so on. No, she's a Buddhist practitioner in Canberra. Yeah. I've never met her, but I hope to meet her when I go to Canberra next time. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
What happened to the discussion group on Sutta Central?
We're still there.
I sort of lost it, but...
No, we're still there. Mostly they're these days discussing about Ajahn Brahm's resignation. That's the main topic of discussion today. So, that's also there. Yeah.
So, Ajahn Sujato, on the YouTube streaming today, there's lots of good feedback and thanks to you. One of the questions was from Godfrey in Ireland. And
hey, Godfrey, how you going?
Yeah, and so he said, I've just read in the Vinaya on Sutta Central, a monk who teaches a woman more than six sentences of the word of Buddha must confess the offence, and he's looking for some clarification on what's happening there.
Thank you.
People are reading Sutta Central.
Yeah, that's good, that's good. So this is one of the Vinaya rules. That's one of a series of rules which is about regulating conduct in private between monks and women. So that the idea is that you shouldn't be like alone without anybody around. So if I was to say invite someone, one of the ladies here, Barbara or someone, to just come into my room and say let's learn Dhamma and sit down and explain Dhamma at length with her in private, then that would probably wouldn't be a good idea. But to do it briefly would be okay. So if somebody has a Dhamma emergency and they say, actually one of the exceptions that they say traditionally is that you can, if you answer a question, it's okay. So that's all right. So if you come and say, what's this Diga Nikaya thing, then you can just say the whole of the Diga Nikaya and that's all right. And another exception, see, this is one of the funny details in the Vinaya, another one is that it's fine if it's not about Dhamma. So if you're just chit-chatting about random nonsense, you can do that as much as you like. But it's only talking about Dhamma that you have to be careful with. So I know it's a bit weird, but the Vinaya is a bit weird sometimes. What can I say? So you have to interpret it according to the spirit of it. But basically the spirit of it is that you should just be careful to get into those kind of intimate situations where a monk is speaking alone with a woman. Yeah. And obviously the same applies for nuns who are alone with men. Okay. Any other questions there?
Yes, there was actually one more question from Justine in Canada. She says,
hey Justine,
are there any aspects of the suttas that strike you as particularly misunderstood in prior translations? Is studying Pali preferred and necessary for thorough understanding of the suttas?
Okay, so the first question is studying Pali necessary? Sorry, I'll just... turn off the things that are... so is studying Pali necessary? Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, to get enough kind of general knowledge to really understand the Dhamma and to practice the path, then no, it's not necessary to learn Pali. But if you really are interested and you really sort of want to go into specific points and details, then learning Pali can be very helpful. But in terms of, for practical purposes, no, I don't think it's essential to learn Pali. And so the other question you said, what are there things that are particularly misleading in earlier translations? Well, I mean, a couple of those we addressed already, but I'll just mention one thing which I can't remember if I talked about it the other night. I think I might have talked about it the other night, so I probably won't talk about it again. Any other thing which is specifically misleading? Oh, let's have a look down here. Okay, well, what I've got here is a list of... These are the essays which I wrote about the suttas, and on these are under the tag EBT Translation on the forum. And so here are the titles, and so you can... I'm going to scroll gently down these titles, and you can see if there's anything interesting there. The politics of the Buddha's genitals, perhaps. Anything that you want to learn more about, then please yell out and we'll have a look at that. Really? No one went for that one. I'm surprised. You've... You sure? Really? But you're the only one so far. That's not embarrassing or anything. No, you're good. Checking that motion. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. I'm not sure what you're asking.
Oh, let's say in, I don't know, sutra about Buddha talking about the state of the mind of if that person reached enlightenment, like a Sotapanna, Sakadagami.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. I don't know what to say in English.
Of course, yeah.
Like the state of the mind, how we got to explain beyond normal state of the mind. Like, you know, when you go higher, this
okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, and reach enlightenment.
Well, look, honestly, that's a very profound and very complicated question, so I might leave that just for now because it's a bit too much. We're near the end of the class and it would take probably a whole series of classes to address that one. Yeah, sorry
we
about
cannot
that.
Look in the FA, any no. Sutta card, we cannot look in that, yeah?
Yeah, we can.
Okay,
so this is a little essay. Many of you may have know in the Buddhist tradition you have the 32 marks of the great man, right? Which are a traditional list of what the Buddha looked like, and it was supposed to be the fulfillment of a Brahmanical prophecy. Now there are many things that are weird about this. The first thing that's weird about it is, why is the Buddha fulfilling a Brahmanical prophecy? Another thing that's weird is that particular list of 32 marks doesn't actually appear in any Brahmanical texts. Like, normally when the Buddhists say that this such and such a teaching appears in the Brahmanical scriptures, normally they're pretty accurate, right? But in this case, no, there's no mention of it anywhere. And why is all this concern about things? I mean, most of the 32 marks are pretty simple. They're just like the Buddha's teeth are very white and his teeth are very even and these kinds of things. So most of them are pretty straightforward. But then some of them are very weird. And so one of the particular ones which is very weird was the nature of the Buddha's penis. Now, why are we concerned about the nature of the Buddha's penis? I do not know. But there it is. And I'm a translator, so I've got to translate these things. And so what happens is that when somebody wants to come along to see the Buddha and they want to check out, is he really possess all of these marks of the prophecy, but two of them are hidden. Right? They can't see two of them, the nature of his penis and the size of his tongue. Okay, so if somebody sees that they want to do that, he uses his psychic powers to reveal them. Okay, so this is getting weirder, right? So you're sitting there in the audience thinking to yourself, as you do, I wonder what the Buddha's penis is really like. And the Buddha obligingly, right, performs a psychic power miracle so that you get a show. I don't know. It's a little bit weird. Okay. So they use this idea of penis being enclosed in a sheet, right? And this is how it's usually translated. So this has this particular mark of being enclosed in a sheath. But it's kind of a bit weird. however, when I went to have a look at it, it seemed a bit odd because the relevant word is the word kosa. And the word kosa doesn't mean a sheath. It usually means a a storeroom or an enclosure or a cavity. Right? That's the most common meaning of it. And so there's a story of those Jatakas in the Jataka stories. Now, some of the Jataka stories are very, well, they're not safe for work. And they haven't been actually translated into English because the translators were too prudish to put them in English, so they translated them into Latin. Right? In the old days. And so you can't actually get the full version. Anyway, so this particular one, I won't go into the details of what happens in this particular Jataka story, but the story goes that there was a naive lad who was being seduced by a much more worldly woman. And when he saw her private parts, and he was shocked, he had no idea what was going on there. He'd never seen anything like that before. And so he asked, "Is your upper limb ensconced in a cavity?" Right? So he obviously thought that she must have a penis and that somehow it had disappeared or had been pulled into some kind of cavity. And the word for cavity here is kosa, is the same one that's used for the description of a great man. Right? So sometimes, indeed, kosa can mean a sheath, but the main meaning is that of a cavity, and clearly the description is of something that looks like a woman's genitals. And so that's what the Buddha's penis looks like. It's withdrawn into a cavity so that the Buddha's private parts look like a woman's private parts. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? There is an idea. Yeah, not sure. Right. Yeah, so the Buddha didn't have normal genitals, no matter what you're reading of the textiles, and that he was intersex. His genitals look like a woman's. So the idea spiritually is that awakening is beyond gender, right? And I'm not sure if I should read all of this. Anyway, I'll just go through what I wrote here. The Buddha awakening was beyond gender. Such a sense was incorporated in the characteristics of a man, and this is of the great man, and it's no accident. One of the essential features of myth, almost a defining characteristic, is that it embraces ambiguities and contradictions. Telling a story or multiple stories enables us to see things from different perspectives. Rather than resolving a problem one way or another, we develop empathy and can appreciate multiple different perspectives without insisting on any of these as final. So myth stands resolutely opposed to the binaries of true or false. And this perspective is essential to this context. The myth of the great man tells us he must pursue one of two destinies, to become a great king or to become awakened. These are the two career paths offered in countless myths all over the world, starting with the very oldest myth we have, that of the hero Gilgamesh. There is no attempt to reconcile these, to figure out how to be awakened while living at home, or even an argument that one is better than the other. They are just there, irreconcilable but real. I've argued elsewhere that the epithet Vesantara, applied to the Buddha, means in between all, the one who stands apart from all binaries. Thus the Buddha, by choosing the path of renunciation, becomes one who transcends all dualities. This is a paradox, but it's a paradox only to logic, not to myth. Hence, a great man is someone who, in a very real sense, is not fully a man anymore. History shows us that many cultures, desperate to impose their dualities on a world that does not share them, will cut and slice the genitals of infants who seem to be non-conforming. If a baby with fully retracted genitals was born in such a culture, they might have to endure non-consensual surgery. Thankfully, ancient India was not such a culture. In the early texts, drawing on some unknown tradition, they preserved the idea that true greatness meant transcending notions of binary identity and symbolized this by emphasizing the ambiguity of the genitals. Right. Absolutely, yes. Do you want to just repeat that?
I was just saying, like, hermaphrodites in the ancient cultures, and also, like, the artwork that shows right. The male and female in the one statue. So, you know, that speaks to that.
That's right.
Elevation or going beyond both mother, father.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, this is something that's very characteristic of Buddha images, that they're often highly feminized. The Buddha often looks very graceful. That's at the peak of them is the Sukhothai images in Thailand, where the Buddha's walk and stance is very feminine. I believe that this is a way of expressing in a symbolic form, kind of that idea of that transcendence of those binary oppositions. Yeah. Yes, gentleman over here.
Yeah, but some of the other marks of a great man. One is the arms or the hands reached down to the knees.
Right.
Which obviously wasn't the case, because in other parts it sort of says that strangers couldn't pick out the Buddha from
right.
within a group of monks.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
He looked normal.
Right.
Seems to be something.
That's right. Yeah, there are a few of the marks which are a bit, and that's also contradicts. It's internally inconsistent, because in one it says that he can, while standing, touch his knees, which would mean that his arms would have to be extremely long. But it also says that he has an equal proportion, like a banyan tree, which is like the normal proportion. So both of those two can't be the same. So again, I don't think they're meant to be taken too literally. And the manner in which we are to take them is very hard to know, because, as I said, we don't really have the context in which to make sense of them. But they're called the marks of the great man, the Mahapurisa. And that myth of the great man in the Buddhist texts is why I probably didn't explain it very well there, but that myth of the great man in the Buddhist texts is the one who has the choice of either to stay as a king or to go forth and become a Buddha. And that story is a story which is very similar to myths which are found throughout the ancient world, and sort of draws on that mythic heritage. So when we say something's mythic or we say something's symbolic, it doesn't mean to say that it's not true. What we mean is to say that it's a story that has a meaning. And the truth or otherwise of that story is kind of irrelevant to that meaning. Right? So as a historian, we can go back and look and say what's likely to have been the case. And we can say, well, this fact contradicts with that fact, so any one of them can be true. And that's true from a historical point of view. But from a mythic point of view, then it's invariably the case that contradictory facts are both exist in the myth. And that's part of what the point that I was trying to get at there, that's kind of the point of myths, is that they don't have to resolve all of those things. It's about it's about an emotional response. It's about an aesthetic response. It's about creating a sense of meaning. It's not about presenting something that's necessarily logically coherent. So there are different ways of conveying conveying meaning. Yeah. Yeah.
Bhante, so is it saying that the Buddha's genitals were transformed when he became enlightened?
No, these were marks which he had from birth.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, supposedly. Yeah, I'm not sure if you know the story, but traditionally the story was that the soothsayers came to see the Buddha when he was just born, or came to see Siddhartha, and so they looked for these marks on his body.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Again, it's a bit hard to see how they could tell whether standing up he could touch his knees when he was just a newborn baby, but anyway, I'm sure they had their ways. Yes. Hang on. Well, maybe not with the microphone. I don't know.
Well, I guess it just raises the question that if his genitals were transgender or
retracted,
not completely male, then how did he have a son?
Well, I'm not particularly okay with all of the anatomical issues, but I presume that they were kind of retracted rather than non-existent. Yeah. Yeah.
He did have a son.
Yeah. So, yeah, anything.
Are we in any way obliged to believe everything we read in the Buddhist scriptures?
Are you obliged to believe everything you read?
Well,
the thought police will be round to your home, Ainsley. They'll be like, oh my goodness. No, you're not obliged to believe anything.
So we could delete certain ideas out of the Pali Canon, couldn't we, without fear of everlasting damnation?
Could we delete things from the Pali Canon without fear of everlasting damnation? Well, as somebody who is a traditional custodian of the texts and who's someone who feels keenly that responsibility of preserving the texts and passing them down to people, my job is to simply make them available to people, not to pass judgment on them. And I take that very seriously. So that actually, that's one of the reasons why we make quite a distinction between the texts and translations, which are on Sutta Central, which are just, that's what the texts are, and that's what they say, and then the discussions about them, which we have on our forum. And so on the forum, people can express different opinions and agree and disagree with things, and that's fine. And so we sort of foster that kind of discussion. But the texts themselves, we just preserve them. Part of them, you know, you can't expect to have, you know, a million, like the Four Nikayas, which I just translated, is a million words. It's a lot of words, right? And we can't expect to have a million words from ancient India and sort of find all of them to be unproblematic. So I think that the important thing as a community is that there is a space for those conversations to be had and those questions can be raised. And, you know, there's not necessarily a final answer to them. You know, just like that one I was just reading now. I mean, it's obviously not a particularly important topic, if you like, in terms of the understanding of the Dhamma itself, but it may be of importance to some people, particularly perhaps intersex people who maybe can find some kind of sense of connection or something there. And so I think that it's important to just try to represent, for my job, to represent it as plainly as possible and not to try to impose my interpretations in any way more than I need to. I mean, obviously you have to make a decision, but you just try to make the most fair-minded decision you can and open it up for people to discuss that. Yeah.
Excuse my ignorance here, but wasn't there in India a lot of times when androgynous people were classed as mythical or extra spiritual or
for sure, yeah,
things like that? I'm just wondering whether that may have something to do with it.
Yeah, there is a long and complex history of kind of relation with people of non-binary genders in India. I'm not hugely familiar with it, as there was in China and in different places. I mean, the reality is that in all cultures, in all times, in all places, it's never been the case that humans are kind of neatly divisible into male and female. So there's always a kind of tension there. So on the one hand, there's a tension that people try to fit everybody into two camps, but then they don't necessarily fit into two camps. Maybe they're too camped to fit into a camp, if you know what I mean. So okay, that was a bad joke. I think I asked forgiveness for that. But anyway, I couldn't resist. So yes, and then there's that kind of complex and evolving wrestling with that. And yes, sometimes people may be celebrated, sometimes may be repressed, and that's a part of our human history which we have to deal with. Yeah.
Bhante, isn't part of the sort of purpose of myth to actually to raise sort of questions and
absolutely
issues that can be troubling without, so that they can't be lodged to live in that sort of the paradox?
Exactly, yeah. And I did, thank you for mentioning that, because that's, I did a study a few years ago called White Book Bones, Red Rot, Black Snakes. It was a study of mythology in Buddhism. And that was really kind of one of the main sort of takeaways that I had from doing that study. And, you know, just like in Buddhism, like one of the basic like almost like a tear or a tension is when the Buddha went forth from home and left his parents weeping behind him, right? So on the one hand, we say, well, we should always be kind to each other and we should respect our parents and things, and that's one set of values. And on the other set of value, we celebrate the Buddha for going away and leaving his family and so on. And that, in a sense, that's irreconcilable. You can't solve that problem, right? But it's something which is not solved. It's something which is lived. And you can tell stories about it. So you can't ever say that it's fixed, because it's not. And it's a tension which everybody feels, whether or not they go forth or not, right? We feel a tension between the pull of the world and the pull of the spiritual life, right? And so this is a way of expressing that in a dramatic narrative form. And in the Jatakas, which are the stories ostensibly of the Buddha's past lives, we see that particular juncture is represented again and again and again, in hundreds of different times, each time in a slightly different way. Right? So sometimes the Buddha goes forth, or the Bodhisattva will go forth. Sometimes he'll take his wife with him when he goes forth. Sometimes they'll take the wife and kids, right? Like in the Vaisantara Jataka. Sometimes they'll take the whole, and sometimes he was a king, and the whole kingdom went with him when they went forth. So the whole kingdom ended up in the Himalayas in a big ashram there. Right? So all the different ways. And one of my favourites is one of the Jatakas where the Bodhisattva is sitting together with the woman who was to be his wife, Maya, in this life. And they're sitting at the dinner table, and the Bodhisattva says to Maya, my dear, I love you so much and I love our children, but I really want to go forth and become a monk. And she says, well, it's funny that you say that, because I really want to go forth and become a nun. And they say, well, I suppose we have to wait until the kids grow up and then we can do that. And Maya says, well, okay, that sounds fine. And so a bit later on in the evening, Maya says, excuse me, darling, I just have to pop outside to get some water from the well. So she goes outside and doesn't come back. And she leaves him to bring up the kids. And so he does that, brings the kids up until they're old enough to look after themselves, and then he goes forth to become a monk. And then later on, he happens to run into his former wife. You left me. And so this, the way that story is told, and that's life. It's not just one thing or the other. It's so many of these different experiences that people have. Yeah. Looks like we're running a bit over time, so we should probably wrap that up. Thank you so much for coming and for those very interesting questions. And I hope that you enjoy Sutta Central and the work that we've done. And I'd also like to thank yourselves and the Buddhist Society for their support in getting the site going and giving me the opportunity to do this work. So I really appreciate that. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.